Microphones are live.
Frank's going to do. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. As we convene the August 13th meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors, I will remind folks that if you are having trouble hearing the proceedings in chambers, we do have hearing assist devices at the end of the dais. And with that,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham.
It should be pointed out, Mr. Chair, that Judge Clark's legacy lives on here in our county with our excellent county counsel, Nina Negranti. So many legacies he leaves, including one for us.
Indeed. Supervisor Arnold?
I'd just like to say a few words as well. Judge Clark was a longtime friend of our family, and I knew him as a cattle rancher's family from the ranching business, but also as a mentor through all the years that I spent involved in politics. And he was a wonderful man, And I think, actually, after reading his book, he was so humble, he never really told a lot of stories about his work in Washington, D.C., but he played a huge role in global affairs and made the world a better place. So we will miss him.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold. Indeed, a remarkable public servant, and our sympathies, our thoughts, our prayers to his friends and family. With that, Madam Clerk, could you read the changes to today's agenda, please?
Certainly. An amended item is item 20, the Women's Jail Update and Bid Opening. Staff is amending recommendation number 2 to read, adopt contract documents for the Women's Jail Expansion Project. The amended recommendation eliminates language authorizing the clerk to advertise the bids for construction services, as language instructing the clerk to provide notice to bidders is already contained in recommendation number 5. All requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied, as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement.
That's a good thing. Thank you, Madam Clerk. With that, we'll go into our consent agenda. Again, on all items, if you would please have your speaker slips filled in and turned in before the start of each item. For consent, I have two requests to speak. One, John Hollenbeck, and followed by Eric Greening. Mr. Hollenbeck.
Good morning, Board. I'm here to talk about item 2, which is the 100th anniversary of the Atascadero Mutual Water Company. I'm a resident of Atascadero. I'm a civil engineer and worked on several water projects, including one for the county here. And it was during that engagement working on Nacimiento that I got to know the board of directors at the Mutual Water Company and also their general manager. And several of the board members are also Rotarians, and I'm in the same Rotary Club as them. So I think it's a great celebration for their 100th anniversary. You're going to hear from them, I believe, momentarily. But I'm also a person that believes in marking historical events. I'm really glad to see that your board has something on its agenda today to mark the 100th anniversary of the existence of the Atascadero Mutual Water Company. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hollenbeck. Mr. Greening?
Thank you. I am Eric Greening. Good morning. And on that note, as someone who is 70% water and lives in Atascadero, I would like to thank the Mutual Water Company for the fact that I and everyone else in the area is alive. That's a very important thing. I did want to talk about item 9. This relates to the grant that you had a public hearing to accept a few weeks ago relative to a streamlining project for lands on which renewable energy facilities, primarily solar, would be constructed. And I remember at the hearing Mr. Caruso say this would involve some very significant changes to ordinances and perhaps general plan policies in our conservation element, even though it implements a program that is mentioned in the conservation element. It could have very significant impacts on current biological and cultural resources policies to the extent that we would be identifying lands and doing environmental review of those lands prior to an actual specific project description for what would happen on those lands. And this raises in particular a question relative to cultural resources, because many lands in our county are culturally sensitive, and we do have significant laws that have to be obeyed. And so my question is, what type of consultation with what native people and what agencies will occur at what stages in the development of projects and in the action under this contract that you're approving today, so that nothing gets lost in the shuffle? Obviously, I also have considerable concerns with biological resources, but we don't have the same operative laws. We simply have agencies that are looking over shoulders.
Thank you for allowing me to speak, Mr. Chairman and the board. I would ask you to consider not awarding this grant to PMC on item 9, since they are the ones that brought ICLEI to our county. This company has profited handsomely from bringing and encouraging smart growth and sustainable development to our county government. The wasteful, destructive nature of this overarching doctrine causes local politicians to focus on extremist environmental projects, grant monies, and career advancement rather than what these elected officials were elected to do. Now over $500,000 is being granted to this organization to streamline green renewable energy projects, whereas regular projects must continue to be held up by biased staff that uses every possible rule and ordinance to slow down normal business. Please do not give smart growth projects special treatment, but insist that staff streamline all projects, as the growing body of scientific articles states. Global warming is a hoax, CO2 is good for the planet, and sea level rise is insignificant. Let these renewable energy projects compete on the open market if they are as productive as is claimed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dawson. That concludes public comment on consent. I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board, ask colleagues if they have items to pull. Mr. Hill?
None, sir.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes, it's two. Item 2 for presentation, please.
Okay, Mr. Meacham.
2 and 7.
2 and 7. We'll start with 2. Ms. Arnold.
Yes. So it is really a pleasure today to see the Atascadero Mutual Water Company, John Neal's here, and board member Gregor Jones, and then we just heard from John Hollenbeck coming to receive this resolution. There's been a lot of talk about water in the North County, especially water supply in this drought year we're experiencing. And I'll be reading this resolution that commemorates, and apparently today is the actual day. This isn't just commemorating the year. Today is the 100th birthday of the Atascadero Mutual Water Company. We've heard a lot about solving water supply problems over the years and political decisions that were made. So in reading this resolution, people will be able to hear about futuristic planning for water supply that started 100 years ago and then was carried on by men like you. So, again, I take great pleasure in being able to recognize you with this resolution that reads, whereas on this day in 1913, E.G. Lewis filed the Articles of Incorporation for the Atascadero Mutual Water Company, establishing the first business in Atascadero. And whereas the Atascadero Mutual Water Company continues to operate in its original form as a private, nonprofit, mutually owned corporation whose shareholders are the property owners in its service area, and whereas for the past 100 years, Atascadero Mutual Water Company has been providing its shareholders with a continuous, safe, and reliable supply of water at a reasonable cost while providing the highest level of customer service. And whereas, to ensure that a safe and continuous supply of water is available for its shareholders, Atascadero Mutual Water Company is one of the initial four participants in the Nacimiento Water Project. And whereas Atascadero Mutual Water Company continues to be an active member of the Water Resource Advisory Committee, the Paso Robles Groundwater Basin Blue Ribbon Steering Committee, and is an active participant in other regional water planning efforts. And whereas Atascadero Mutual Water Company has 21 full-time employees that are dedicated to providing exceptional customer service, collectively, these employees have over 170 years of experience operating and maintaining the water company's water production, treatment, and distribution system. So now, therefore, be it resolved that the County of San Luis Obispo Board of Supervisors, State of California, does hereby recognize the Atascadero Mutual Water Company for 100 years of dedicated service in providing a continuous, safe, reliable, and affordable supply of water to its shareholders in both the City of Atascadero and in San Luis Obispo County. Thank you.
Gentlemen, if you'd like to come receive the resolution.
Can we do a photo op?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
You look great. You look fabulous. I want you to know that.
I think we're the model for conservation in the county, and she gets a lot of requests to help out other agencies. But that's all I have to say, but John Neal, who is our manager, can give you a little bit of history.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Neal?
Good morning. I'm not going to get too much into the history. It was 100 years ago today that they filed the Articles of Incorporation for the water company. E.G. Lewis, he was really a great visionary. He put us in a unique position. He bought the ranch, deeded all the water rights of the ranch from the ranchos that made up Atascadero to the water company, and then he entrusted those water rights to us and then proceeded with his subdivision. And that hierarchy is really important in our ability to serve our customers with the various water resources that are available. And it's because of his vision, Atascadero Mutual has the good fortune to have water sources that are reliable, and production, treatment, and distribution systems that are sound. Our job now is to leave a legacy that demonstrates our dedication to reliability, expresses our high regard for our shareholders, and demonstrates diligent stewardship of what has been entrusted to us. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Neal, and congratulations on 100 years of service to your community. We appreciate you being here to celebrate with us. With that, Mr. Meacham, number 7.
Well, I wanted to comment on number 2 as well. Okay, I had the opportunity to work with all three of these gentlemen for a number of years, and it took the collaboration of several communities to come together to put together that Nascimento Water Project. And I really enjoyed working with these folks. They take these issues very seriously, and they have a good mind to try to find ways to come to solutions with these whole things. So I really appreciated working with all three of you, and congratulations. You're 100 years old, and no, I was not here then. But thank you.
So you say. All right, sir. We'll take your word for that. And again.
And number 7.
Congratulations. Number 7, sir.
I know he did not want to have any kind of public appearance for this, but John Bissell is going to be retiring after 27 years. Just a really, really nice man and a very, very good resource for information. So I wish him well on his 27 years after 27 years and retiring. So he's not here, but good luck, John.
Here's to that. Mr. Bissell's worked on a number of complicated and at times contentious issues in the 2nd District as well, and always with great professionalism. Yeah. Ms. Arnold?
I, too, have had the pleasure over the many years of working with John Bissell in the in and around the 5th District, and his calm demeanor always was appreciated when there were some controversial issues.
Always.
We'll miss him.
All right. With that, I would entertain a motion on consent, please.
So moved.
Second. Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Mr. Hill? Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. With that, come to general public comment period. I have 9 requests to speak, so we'll go with those. We'll start with Eric Greening, followed by Daniela Sapriel, please.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I also would like to thank John Bissell for his exemplary service. And I hope that in his retirement he's out there with his camera a lot, because he's a very fine photographer. Since we're 1 week from the hearing of the 6th on the Paso Robles Groundwater Basin and 2 weeks before the one that's going to be the one where you presumably may adopt something in the way of policy or ordinance, I wanted to give a little in-between background on things that might be better fleshed out in the staff report for it. I know Supervisor Arnold was talking about wishing that state water could be deployed in the places that are hurting, and with the thought that it might even happen more immediately than an ordinance could create a physical solution. It's a kind of a complicated issue, and from my own researches in it and from participating in the North County Water Forum's task force on off-stream storage, I see two main possibilities. One would be simply drizzling it into the basin and having us own it. That would require a subscription. It would require that we form an entity that would in fact subscribe. And that would actually go counter to some policies. If it were going to be used for agriculture, it would go counter to some existing policies of the Central Coast Water Authority that would have to be overcome. Also, presumably to be overcome, would be a considerable steep financial obligation of buying in to the basically whatever the entity's share of all the capital work that had been done on its behalf before it organized and subscribed. And so that would be one possible way, and as you can see, there are some steep obstacles. The other, which the complications and obstacles as well as the opportunities.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Thank you. Ms. Sapriel, followed by Mike Brown.
Thank you, Chairman Gibson, members of the board. Daniela Sapriel, Templeton. I'm here sort of as a follow-up with the Supervisor Arnold's statement at the last meeting that, you know, as much information or questions that could be answered by members of the public would be appreciated. And I'm here to follow up on my follow-up letter to the board, because after I reviewed the video, I actually did what I should have done before I came on the 6th, which is actually read the enabling statute that allows for an interim ordinance. And as soon as I did that, a lot of the confusion and the division and the way the entire discussion was framed, it became very clear that it was an incorrect framing. So as I said in my letter, I would really urge all members of the board, the staff, county council, members of the public, myself included, to be really clear that this is not an urgency ordinance. This is not an emergency ordinance. This is an interim ordinance. And as soon as you do that, and I know it seems like kind of semantic hair splittings, but as soon as you actually go to the language of the enabling statute, it becomes very clear what the framing should be, which is that this is an interim ordinance designed to kind of just hit the pause button so that the underlying issues can be addressed. And so I really ask the board to make a commitment to make sure that the description is accurate so that the framing is accurate. On a second issue, briefly, as we see in the headlines, residents, and they actually say landowners, are rushing for new well permits. And we're seeing exactly what staff warned us about, which is everybody afraid that regulation is going to come. And so I would ask, and I don't know if this is possible or how the well department works, but that the board or whoever make sure that the department is instructed that residents, rural residents who have actually lost their wells, that those permits be given priority, and that the people who are just kind of rushing in trying to avoid regulation, you know, not be given the same priority. And then just as the very last issue, I know that everyone wants to avoid a lawsuit and that a lot of the inaction has been, well, what can we do to kind of avoid a lawsuit? And I'm going to tell you, as someone who has been an on-and-off lawyer for 35 years, there's no way you're going to avoid a lawsuit. Someone will sue. So the real issue is, what side of history do you want to be on? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Safriel. Mr. Brown, followed by Elsa Dawson.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. In a couple of weeks, you are scheduled to consider what you've called an urgency ordinance. And we were wondering if you know, as board members, how many wells are dry in the Paso Robles water basin. Is it 10? Is it 100? Is it 200? Would seem to be an important thing for you to know, to contemplate this action, which, whatever you call it, impacts people's ability to do things. In addition to knowing how many, knowing where they are, seems that due diligence here would be to find that out, even to the extent that you could put them on a map. It would be interesting to see what the pattern is, how they lay out. It may be that staff is working on that, but we haven't seen it yet. And then along with that, which wells are likely to go dry in the term of the urgency ordinance? I think you're targeting to try and do 2 years. So just what is going on out there? And it would seem that public works and planning, along with your IT department, could do some work and try to figure this out and field verify it. And we think that would be important before you consider this. And then secondly, how much water is the urgency ordinance likely to save or forestall the use of? When you did the moratorium on new subdivisions as a result of the level 3 severity, I think staff calculated that it was about 17.5 acre feet. And that
captives of big money corporations, I don't agree. We appreciate your level-headed and realistic assessment of the future of North County's economic vitality. And we appreciate the serious reservations you have about the legality of such an ordinance. In addition, whether or not the plans proposed by staff even include or offer immediate relief or solutions for people whose wells are dry. After all, those are your districts. And I am quite curious about the motives of the two supervisors who have become such vocal and aggressive advocates for the North County people. Could this be a diversion to mask failures closer to home, emergencies in your own districts? I encourage the people of North County, who are persuaded to view you as compassionate and caring, to take note of the deaf ear that you turn to the pleas of the Los Osos residents and their water problems. But speaking of compassion, did you listen to Mr. Lara, the leader of the Hispanic community, who compassionately interceded for more than 30,000 workers employed in the ag and hospitality industries in our county last week? Now, what about the board's fundamental responsibility to those hardworking members of our community? What will their fate be as a result of your fair system of governance? Also, last week I was alarmed by Mr. Hill's assertion that the ag community won't cooperate voluntarily and must be forced by the board to work together. What is your field verification for such a domineering and divisive pronouncement? It appears, really, that some of you are taking advantage of two crises. You're most certainly capitalizing on the drought and on the fear and emotions of the people with dry wells. But secondly, I feel that you're using the untimely death of Supervisor Teixeira to promote your own agenda. You spoke in June of continuing where he left off. But his heart was what's good for the people. His attitude expressed service above self. He was not intolerant of those who didn't agree with him. He did not mock, bully, and intimidate them. Have you forgotten that in May, Paul voted in favor of resource development and against demand management, especially if it took the form of more water use restrictions? Please don't pretend to be carrying on his legacy.
Thank you, Ms. Dawson.
Thank you.
Mr. Dawson, followed by Julie Tacker.
Tom Dawson, even though a lawsuit is inevitable, what is defensible in court? The staff suggested urgency ordinance recommendations and were severely lacking in scientific and statistical information. How many wells have gone dry? Where are they? Are they only along El Palmar? Where is the plot map? Which lenses or pools do they draw from? Are these pools down because of drought or overdraft? We don't really know. Are those who have drilled deeper or re-drilled deeper having problems? What about the area near the airport where water is 12 inches below the surface? What, if any, is the water level drop in wells in other areas besides the El Palmar area? Are the deep wells seeing water level drop, and how much? Who among you will dispel the one big bathtub theory being promoted? Is the basin in danger of collapse? We don't know. Where are the Blue Ribbon Committee reports that you called for and their final conclusions? The Pro Water Equity Group seems to have two parts, sincere homeowners, some of whom have real needs, a leadership who seems to have a history of promoting extremist environmentalist causes such as no growth and the ICLEI smart growth from Agenda 21, thus creating hysteria to pressure political leaders into making rash decisions. One thing I notice is that an extreme basin-wide urgency ordinance will not solve much, but it will achieve many smart growth objectives. One of ICLEI's and Agenda 21's main tools is to get control of water through ambitious politicians. To the supervisors that are still doing the people's work, the people's business, and not that of ICLEI, I say don't let this small vocal group and progressive newspapers shout you in.
What I wanted to point out or bring to your attention today is this: as many as 16 million gallons of water per day that we're talking about when we are to dewater Los Osos for construction of the wastewater project. 16 million gallons a day are proposed to be discharged somewhere. Currently, the last resort has become option one. The last resort was the Morro Bay National Estuary. That water is being dumped into Morro Bay. I've passed out a letter from the Regional Water Quality Control Board. I don't know that your staff has shared that with you yet, so I do encourage you to read it. What the Regional Board has said in that letter, and they said it in May of 2011, is that discharge to the bay was a last resort, in that they would determine whether or not land application was infeasible. Your staff has allowed contractors to make that judgment call, and they are dumping to Morro Bay National Estuary. What they've also done is failed to test the water thoroughly to be certain
that it does not have contaminants in it that would not only harm construction workers who might be walking in it, working in it, touching it, breathing it, or the people who live in the neighborhoods where the water is harvested. They haven't tested and they haven't analyzed how that water will impact the Morro Bay National Estuary. This is the very estuary that we were charged to protect and build a $200 million sewer in order to do so. I want to point out that my supervisor is a Jekyll and Hyde. The red zone in Paso Robles and the 15,000 people affected by it are more important than the 15,000 people in the red zone of the aquifers of Los Osos.
Thank you, Ms. Tecker. Ms. Owen, followed by Dr. C. Height.
Good morning, Lindy Owen from Los Osos. About water, Chair Gibson, what is the when are you going to call an emergency in Los Osos? Why is our water of no importance to you in your own district? We just heard what the proposal of this project, which you are completely 100% behind, you haven't lifted a finger to come in and resolve any of the concerns that we have. 8 to 16 million gallons a day for up to a year, possibly more, while they deep trench the high groundwater areas. This project was promised that they would put that water back in our basin someplace, because after all, we're in a level 3 severity. We don't have a drop to waste. Yet your project has never found a place to put it. They said they'd put it on the Tri-W Midtown site. Well, it can't even hold 500,000 a day. It's already, it's causing a violation onto neighboring property, pouring over and creating erosion on other property. The Broderson leach fields we spent so much time and money on, you never put the pipe up there to put the water in it. You are responsible for losing our water by letting the regional board, by pretending that maybe the regional board would look the other way while you dumped 8 to 16 million of our upper aquifer water. It's all we have left. We don't have Nacimiento water. We don't have desal. We don't have state water. We have an upper aquifer that you are willing to dump into the bay and at the same time have emergency proposals up in Paso Robles to try to help them save their basin. I'm sorry, I just do not get it. I believe you are a Jekyll and Hyde. Last week, you had an overflow room on the Paso water issue. I want to talk about your process that you've installed since Supervisor Teixeira's gone and you're taking his place. We have new changes. Last week, we had 12 people for public comment. You cut our public comment down to 2 minutes. Then when you began your the Paso Water Basin Emergency Ordinance discussion, you had over 100 speakers. You offered them 1 minute, 2 minute, or 3 minute. And then even in the afternoon session, you took in two late slips, which you just have told us were not allowed. What is this? I mean,
how much public comment we were going to have. And you purposely brought it to test me. Well, the test is this, Mr. Margetson. Given the state of things, I will let you speak after we get our other business done this morning. We have other business on this agenda, and the reason, as I've stated before, that I ask for speaker slips in before the start of the item is so folks can plan their day regarding the other business before this board. So with that, another outburst, and we'll ask you to leave. Dr. Height, followed by Mr. DeFano.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos Rural Community Workshop. Each Board of Supervisors has received an email. This public records request is 11 pages for attachments, including a reattachment of the Los Osos Sewer Project update. Public records request, August 13, 2013. This is a public records request made by Dr. C. Height of the County of San Luis Obispo, California. This August 13, 2013 public records request is made under the California Public Records Act. The requester does request within 10 business days. The County of San Luis Obispo does provide any tangible evidences, memo or email, that shows that the District 2 supervisor did responsibly address the issues of evacuation of Emergency Planning Zone 5, Los Osos, during the ongoing construction of the Los Osos Wastewater Project. To encourage the county's cooperation with this public records request, the requester is sending a CC of said request to the U.S. Senator from California, Dianne Feinstein. And you're going to receive all 11 pages as it prints out when I conclude. The county may inform the requester in a timely manner what has been done to date to advise all responsible parties of the ongoing construction and to see to it that there is a workable evacuation plan for Los Osos, California, other than shelter in place. The requester does make this important public records request for the following reasons, and here's some of them. It is known that Diablo Canyon is an aging nuclear power plant within the coastal area of San Luis Obispo, California. It is known that the coastal community of Los Osos, California has a demographic of transportation-dependent senior disabled citizens. The requester has publicly advocated for equity and inclusion of senior disabled population since 2003. The requester has specifically advocated for the equal opportunity to evacuate and survive a PG&E event. As can be seen in the board minutes from April 20th, 2004. Reverend C. Height addresses the people with disabilities and the unmet need with regards to transportation in the case of an evacuation, asks for equal opportunity for the disabled during a PG&E alert, states above ground storage is an unacceptable risk. The requester is one of many who have expressed concerns regarding the above ground storage of nuclear waste and relicensing of Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. The April 20th, 2004 advocation before the County Board of Supervisors by the requester constitutes notice. The September 13, 2011 advocation before the County Board of Supervisors by the requester constitutes notice. The requester did ask the county for a county representative for the seismic peer review who was open-minded.
Thank you, Dr. Height. And Mr. DeFada.
Good morning, Board, Sheriff, Public. I am Ben DeFada from Los Osos, where hundreds of 2 feet by 2 feet square holes are drilled every 50 to 100 feet on certain blocks, filled with sand, then covered with asphalt that after it seeps into the sand, we end up with a 6-inch to 12-inch deep pothole that inflicts major damage to your car and probably your physical body. My subject today is the dewatering of trenches and where to store it with Mr. Gibson and Auger's antiquated overpriced unaffordable deep trench gravity stinking sewer project that sits on a sand dune in a liquefaction zone with as many as 12 earthquake faults under Los Osos and close to the Diablo power plant. Mr. Gibson and Auger, who have never built a $200 million sewer project before, for their own reasons, doesn't want anybody to oversee this project for whatever reason they won't say. But here's a 4-page letter from the Water Quality Agency to Waddell saying, get your act together. An outside Blue Ribbon Committee could point out problems before they occur, thus saving us a ton of money and time that could become a big problem for this county. We're down the road when all the costs have been added up to this county, Los Osos could be liable for many cost overruns for this massive sewer project for the many mistakes and changes by the county. Property owners in the probation zone could try to recoup some of those monies in the future with lawsuits. Terrible management, poor coordination between contract. Fortunately, cooler heads had always prevailed and you backed off, or the subject backed off. And as a side note, we now see ocean fish in San Diego with 10 times the radiation of normal. You must get rid of PG&E. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. DeFada. With that, we'll close public comment. I would like, Mr. Waddell, if you would come, please. We have noticed some increase in discharge from Tri-W site. Could you speak to the dewatering issues at Tri-W?
Yes, sir. I'm John Waddell, County Public Works Department. The dewatering for the trenches, which is a planned and necessary part of the project, including the project permits, is underway. We're dewatering to land wherever possible, including to the Tri-W site. And this week we've been aware that the water is leaving the site and going into the drainage, the Ravina drainage, so natural drainage course next to the site, where then it's percolating into the ground. So most of the water is percolating at Tri-W. Some is then going into that ditch and percolating. So there's no discharges to surface water from that there's no discharges to surface water from that. It's going into again into a sandy area where then it percolates, and we're working to work with the landlords to just make sure everything is buttoned up and all the bases are covered, but it's something we're working on, and we're also working on response to the regional board's letter.
Okay, and so we are working with the regional board, and at this point in compliance with all permits that have been issued.
Yes, that is the key point, especially for the surface water discharge, is we're in compliance with the construction stormwater permit.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Mr. Meacham?
I do. I just want to make a quick comment. Those of you that have come again to speak about the water issue, and I can assure you, I know that Supervisor Arnold is the same situation. I think I go to bed thinking of water, wake up thinking about water, and thinking about water all through the day. We are looking at the upgraded maps. We are looking at locations of where this may be affecting others, so that way we can come to a really, I want to be on firm footing in whatever we do. And so we are researching all of that, and I think you'll see a lot of good information that's going to be coming forward. So just wanted to comment on that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Meacham. I know it's a big issue. Ms. Arnold.
Yes. And thank you for that, Supervisor Meacham. I spoke for both of us there. But I just want to go on the record saying one more thing. And I'm sorry to see any kind of disagreement with the folks that come to speak. I do feel like it's part of our job to listen to all of you when you come here. Have your 3 minutes, and whether we agree or not, we're here to listen to you, the people. And I wish that we could allow folks to come in and be able to speak if they're here during a particular agenda item at any point in time, be able to come to the podium, because I do want to hear from them.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold. With that, Madam Clerk, would you introduce the next item, please?
Certainly. And that would be item 15, a hearing to consider protest regarding the proposed assessment for the Track 1747 Street Light Assessment District, District 4.
Thank you. Presenting today, Mr. Diodati. Get your PowerPoint up. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Chairman Gibson, members of the board. My name is John Diodati with the Public Works Department, and I am here for the Proposition 218, Track 1747 Streetlight Assessment. And this item started in June with a consent item that initiated the Proposition 218 proceedings. Most of you are familiar with the proceedings. It's a property owner assessment ballot approval, and in June, your board tentatively approved the assessment engineer's report, which laid out the yearly assessment for the property owners, which is to pay for the electricity and maintenance of the streetlights in their development area. And the clerk mailed those ballots. There's a 45-day window that the ballots have to be out on the street for property owners to have them think about it, review the engineer's report, call staff and ask questions. And then that ends today with a public hearing that your board will open, allow for public testimony. Property owners can submit their ballots at that time. They can withdraw their ballots. They can even change their ballots if they wish up until the close of the public hearing. And then at the close of the public hearing, the clerk won't be taking any more ballots. We'll announce when we're going to count the ballots in a public area.
At our regular scheduled board.
Correct. Mr. Meacham.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill.
Yes.
Ms. Arnold.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Diodati, Mr. Marshall. Mr. Ferran.
Yes, so one comment before we leave here. We should give an announcement as to when the clerk's office will be opening the ballots and counting the ballots.
Mr. Diodati specified it would be tomorrow at 9 a.m. in our office.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Very good. So we can include that in the record of this public hearing, that that is the appointed time and place. Thank you very much. With that, we'll move on then to our next item. Madam Clerk, if you would, please.
Your next item would be item 16, report on the activities of the Homeless Services Oversight Council.
And Ms. Jackson, are you going to start it off for us?
I am. I'm going to provide an introduction to this item very briefly. Good morning. Emily Jackson from the County Administrative Office, here to introduce this item on an update on homeless activities over the past year within the county. If you'll recall, in April of 2012, the county created a homeless services coordinator position in the Department of Social Services to address some increased and ongoing workload in the area of homelessness and also to provide additional staff support to the Homeless Services Oversight Council, which had previously been provided by staff in the Planning and Building Department. At the time that the position was created, the board requested and staff indicated that we would provide annual updates on homeless activities within the county, and so that's what this item is intended to do today. The staff report for this item is fairly detailed, the intent being that we wanted to keep today's discussion publicly at a higher level and allow for some back and forth and any questions that your board may have or comment that the public would like to provide. Before I turn it over to Laurel here, as a matter of some background, in 2008, the 10-year plan to end homelessness was created. That was a title that was actually directed by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. In 2009, the county then created the Homeless Services Oversight Council as an advisory body to the Board of Supervisors on issues related to homelessness. At the time that the HSOC was created, it was a board of 24 members. Today, it's actually increased to 27 members, given some recent HUD and continuum of care requirements. With such a broad membership on the HSOC, staff identified a real need to have staff support for HSOC, but also to coordinate all of the various interests and activities related to homelessness that were going on in the county. And so in April of last year, we brought a recommendation to the board, and the board approved the creation of a homeless services coordinator position in the Department of Social Services. And Laurel Weir was hired last July, and so she's been here just over a year. And so I'm going to turn it over to her. She's going to provide an update on homeless activities over the past year.
Thank you, Emily. Shortly after I arrived, HUD had issued new regulations implementing the Homeless Emergency Assistance and Rapid Transition to Housing Act, known as HARTH. We receive over $1 million from HUD for homeless assistance funding in our county, and these regulations govern that funding. The changes that they made were sweeping as a result of the HARTH Act, requiring a more coordinated and comprehensive approach, requiring communities to tie intensity of services to intensity of need, and placing an emphasis on permanent housing over transitional housing. And the changes reflected evidence and experience over the past 20 years around the country about what works. The county's Homeless Services Oversight Council, known as HSOC, responded to the new regulations, making changes to HSOC structure and policies and preparing for the increased coordination. The changes that we have already made helped us to requalify for the $1 million in HUD funding this year, as some of the changes went to effect more immediately than others. HUD is also asking communities to move away over the next year from a housing-ready approach, which requires that people get mental health or other treatment before they can get housing, to a housing first approach, which puts people into housing and provides treatment and services concurrently. And I'll talk more about that in a few minutes. This year, the HSOC also made changes to methodology to a drop in family homelessness. It's going to look like the numbers of families have dropped significantly, and unfortunately, they have not. But we are no longer including the families who are living doubled up with others, as HUD does not consider them to be homeless for the count. For the enumeration this year, it's important to understand a little bit about the what it is and what it does and doesn't tell us. An enumeration is a point in time count. It's a single snapshot of the homeless population on a single 24-hour period. It's very helpful to us because it collects data on people who are not receiving any kind of services. So this is our chance to find out how many of those people are there and to find out a little bit about those people who aren't in our shelters and who are currently living unsheltered. The enumeration is very important for this purpose. At the same time, it's important, thank you. It's important not to look only at the enumeration data if we want to get a full picture of what's happening with our homeless population. The data collected by our service agencies collects data over time, and if you look at a single point in count, you will find that certain populations are overrepresented and certain populations are underrepresented. So it is important to look both at annual data, sources of annual data, as well as that single snapshot, because that will give you a more complete idea of what's happening. Currently, we are working with our consultant and HSOC subcommittee to look at all of the annual data from homeless services, from schools, and other systems to develop a report that will contain the most complete picture. And we anticipate formal release of that in the next few weeks. So we will provide that to you as soon as it's available. And we are working with all of the homeless services providers, as well as all of the agencies working with homeless people, to kind of identify and develop a consensus around the key findings of the enumeration. In our discussions that we have already had, a couple of points have been brought forth by the members of our community and the all the groups that are working closely with homeless people about some of the points that are very important, and you see some of the key findings here, particularly the issue of mental health numbers being up. This will appear to be an increase from the 2011 count. In part, this is due to a difference in the way we asked the question this time versus in 2011. This time, we added a question specifically about depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. It's the experience of our providers that sometimes when you ask people if they have a mental illness or experiencing mental illness, that they don't think of depression or PTSD as a mental illness. So we did find that more people answered yes to those questions when we asked that this time. So nearly half of the population reported experiencing mental health issues, and this data is actually consistent with our annual data from that we collect from the people who come for services. So I think that's significant. While we're on the topic of data, I wanted to explain briefly about the system that we use to collect data from those who access services. HUD requires agencies that receive HUD homeless assistance funding to enter data into something called the Homeless Management Information System. And that collects information about demographics as well as some background information, duration of homelessness, also questions about veteran status, mental health issues, physical health issues, and other issues that the agencies will need to provide the most appropriate services. We, in the past year, have been looking at, in order for our own purposes, to expand beyond just the agencies receiving HUD funding to other agencies that serve homeless people, such as the Department of Social Services, looking at the possibility of entering that data into the system. There are, unfortunately, not in other counties, other agencies doing this. And the reason we found was that there is the system wasn't really designed for that, and trying to put the agencies in causes problems with the data that are not reflective of what's really happening, but just the kind of fixed choices that we have to make when doing that cause the data to look funny. And we are concerned that right now that entering this information in would result in causing our data to the Supplemental Security Income Program, which is the largest federal disability insurance benefit program, takes an average of 2 years from the time that you apply for disability benefits to the time that you receive them. Nationwide, on average, about 40% of applications are approved the first time. Most of the time, they are denied, and then the people must appeal, and it goes through a lengthy appeal process, which is why it takes, on an average, of 2 years, and in some cases, it can take 6 years. So it's a very lengthy process. Nationwide, our studies also show that for homeless persons, on average, about 15% of applications are approved the first time, and yet we know there's a high incidence of serious disability in the homeless population. So the SOAR process, the SSI Outreach and Access Recovery Training, is a national best practice, and communities or agencies that have implemented the SOAR model have increased the approval rates to a 70% approval rate versus the 15% average for homeless people. And the average time to decision is 101 days. So basically, the SOAR process focuses on trying to get the application right the first time to avoid the need for this constant appeal, and trying to get the decisions made quickly so that people can get their benefits more quickly. And the reason this is important for homeless persons with disabilities is having SSI benefits then makes you eligible for housing. And we are much better able to get people with disability benefits into housing than we are when they don't have those benefits. So it makes a big difference. Also, in the past, it also gave them access to health insurance, which allowed us to provide treatment services. With the Affordable Care Act, that will become a little less important, but the need for the benefits is critical to getting people into housing. So we are placing emphasis on that and training our case managers in this process. We are also, over the past year, been working to provide assistance to agencies wanting to operate warming centers. In South County, Five Cities Homeless Coalition is going to be using the DSS building this winter. I'm also working with a group in North County that is wanting to open up a warming center there. And there have been discussions as well over in Morro Bay about a possibility of warming center there. So I'm working with those groups to kind of help them understand what some of the options are, and sharing information, as are our other homeless services providers, about things to think about when operating those. We've also done presentations to public forums and coordinated with our Veterans Services offices on the veteran stand down.
So before we move on to a conversation about what the focus is going to be in the homeless arena for the coming year, we wanted to take the opportunity to briefly touch on the resources that the county currently dedicates towards homeless activities within the county. The staff report, again, provides a more detailed accounting of these resources, but I wanted to just touch on them. Before I do that, I think it's important to note that these numbers do not include programs that the county provides to low-income folks within our community, many of whom are likely homeless. The health agency and Department of Social Services, for example, provide a large number of programs and have a lot of staff and resources dedicated towards programs aimed at providing health care and other types of assistance to our low-income population, which includes homeless individuals, but not explicitly. So these are numbers that are related to programs that are provided only to homeless individuals within the community. The federal grant programs include a variety of different programs, emergency solutions grants, home investment partnership grants, community development block grants, and continuum of care funding. The allocations for the various federal grant programs don't follow our fiscal year, and so some of the numbers that we have today are still 2012 allocations and some are 2013 allocations. At this point, they've not been allocated out to the various homeless serving agencies within the communities, but the Planning and Building Department and Department of Social Services are currently working on what those allocations will be, and of course that will be run through HSOC and some sort of recommendation made from HSOC to your board later this year, I think in the next couple of months. But so in total, it's about 1.3 that serve strictly homeless individuals. We thought that that was an important distinction to make. And then finally, we wanted to touch a little bit on some of the staff resources within the county that are dedicated to homeless services. In social services, the positions represented are Laurel's position and other staff support for the Homeless Services Oversight Council, as well as some employment resource specialists who run the Benefits Arch program, which Laurel just spoke about. In the Planning and Building Department, staff is primarily focused on all the federal grants management, and as well on administration of the Homeless Management Information System, which Laurel just spoke about as well. It's important to note for the planning and building positions that we do receive some administrative allocations through the federal grant programs to cover the cost of those positions, but as the grants have been decreasing, and particularly the administrative allocations, the county has taken on more of the financial responsibility for paying for some of those positions. And so in total, it's estimated the county is spending about $120,000 to help cover the costs of the staff positions within the Planning and Building Department so that we can ensure that we are adequately administering and managing our federal grant programs to ensure that we're continually eligible to receive that money. And then in the health agency, the positions are related to the Mental Health Services Act Full Service Partnership. And it's important to note that included in the $934,000 is also funding that the county, through the health agency, provides to Transitions Mental Health for an additional 3.3 full-time staff positions. So with that, I'll pass it back to Laurel, and we'll talk about what we have coming up in the coming year.
This spring, the Homeless Services Oversight Council reviewed the county's 10-year plan to address homelessness and chose to focus on one particular strategy this year to really kind of move that implementation forward. And the strategy that it chose was implementing a housing first model of supportive housing. As a first step, the HSOC voted to join the 100,000 Homes campaign, which focuses on this housing first option. And I'm going to talk about the 100,000 Homes campaign a little more in the next slide. HSOC is also going to focus on implementing the HUD regulations that we are required to implement by July of 2014 regarding directing services based on intensity of need, which is going to require
implementing a coordinated intake assessment and referral process, which I'll also talk about just a little bit more in an upcoming slide. And lastly, in improving continuing to improve our data collection and also increasing outcome reporting. So the 100,000 Homes campaign, I think you all have heard me talk about here a little bit before, but it was first begun in 2009. It's been implemented so far in 213 communities nationwide, and they've housed over 60,000 people. And what's notable about that 60,000 people are that those persons were all chronically homeless persons, many of whom had been homeless for 10 years or longer. And these are the people that many people would have thought they would never be able to get off the streets. And the communities who have participated in this campaign have reported that the campaign really accelerated the speed with which they were able to house people who are chronically homeless and led to better coordination, which results in improved outcomes. The campaign focuses on identifying and prioritizing vulnerable homeless persons for housing and using a housing-first approach to begin housing those who have been identified as most vulnerable in the community. And we're going to play a quick video for you that provides a brief overview of what's been happening around the country. So in one point I neglected to mention is when I'm talking about chronic homelessness, HUD defines chronic homelessness as somebody who's been homeless for either continuously for a year or four times in the past 3 years and who has a disability. So all of the people in the film that you saw have some kind of disability, whether it be mental illness or co-occurring disorders or even trimorbidity, which is co-occurring disorders and a physical chronic health condition or a terminal condition. So as we move forward into the next year, the 100,000 Homes campaign is very consistent with the direction that HUD is asking us to move in terms of the intensity of service needs guided or intensity of service guided by intensity of needs. HUD has informed us this summer that they are going to be asking us to limit permanent supportive housing to chronically homeless persons, the idea being that with limited resources, you save your most intensive interventions for those who have the most intensive needs. They're also going to be asking us to develop a uniform process by all of our agencies deciding on common assessment tool and using that to both determine what kinds of services to refer them to, as well as assessing progress in service. And the 100,000 Homes campaign is very consistent also with this and has some assessment tools that we will be considering using as part of this process. Additionally, we will also be working towards an increase in outcome reporting, and the coordinated intake and assessment process will be part of that. Lastly, I just wanted to mention, it's not on the slide, but we will be implementing, DSS will be implementing the Restaurant Meals Program. And I wanted to note that the program is only for homeless, elderly, and disabled CalFresh recipients. What a lot of people don't know is that federal requirements don't allow CalFresh benefits to be used to prepare to purchase prepared food from grocery stores. So you can only purchase unprepared food, so kind of the raw ingredients. And so for homeless people who don't have refrigeration or cooking facilities, also for elderly people and persons with disabilities who might have some difficulty preparing food, the restaurant meals option gives them a chance to utilize their benefits to purchase prepared meals. So certain foods like meats, which are hard to store if you don't have a refrigerator, you can get access to that. So that wraps up my presentation, and I think we'll open it up now for questions.
All right. Anything more, Ms. Jackson? No? Mr. Meacham.
I do. I have about Mr. Hill. A couple, two or three questions, if I could, please. I know that there's a real strong emphasis, it appears, on gathering more data and more quality data. Can you give me an example of what quality data would mean?
Yes. Example of outcomes, where do people exit to when they leave our programs? Are they exiting to permanent housing status, et cetera? Some of the challenges, one issue that we've had is some of our programs have only recently come into the HMIS system. So we only in the past year really have we gotten everyone on board in terms of our homeless service providers. As different agencies have received funding, they have gotten on board. So so getting a baseline for comparison, for one thing. But two, because of the odd way that HUD structured HMIS, it really, when it created it, it was assuming that people would go from shelter from the streets to shelter to transitional to permanent. The 100,000 homes is more the target goal, and so it's not there's not funding that comes with it. What it does is it works with community to figure out how do we do what we're doing in a more coordinated way. How do we remove some of the barriers and shorten the process that it takes to get people into housing? What kinds of bureaucratic barriers are there that we can eliminate and make this smoother?
So it's not, I mean, I'm trying to understand the financial aspect of
yep.
this. Are we purchasing homes, or what are we doing?
No, no. What we're doing is we're going to be tapping into our existing programs, such as our Housing Choice Voucher Program. HUD has made changes in that program to allow for prioritizing highly vulnerable homeless people. It's kind of moving them up the waiting list, essentially.
Okay.
And so, but it also then requires us to, what communities are doing is better coordination about not only putting them into housing, but ensuring they have the services needed. And so it's kind of a shifting of resources. They're also doing it in a way of, like pre-approving some of the apartments so that when you go out to offer housing to somebody that you can move them in right away. And it's there's a lot of work behind the scenes that goes on to make it be more seamless.
I guess, okay, we've found a place for somebody to go.
Yeah.
And how is that paid for? I mean, who pays the rent or who pays for?
We are going to be using primarily Housing Choice Vouchers, which is HUD-funded. We receive a certain number of vouchers each year.
And then I would assume that there's monitoring that takes place.
Yes.
As a follow-up?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, in the case
Thank
management.
You.
Mr. Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have some similar concerns or maybe follow-on to, I think, kind of what Mr. Meacham was driving at. When we adopted, it was a year before I joined the board. So if we look at the 10-year plan, is about 6 years into it. And I understand the need for and the value of the data collection and a lot of the emphasis on the processes and tools and the training and the mm-hmm. compliance. Do we know exactly how many chronically homeless people exist in our community and what percentage of that is of the general homeless population?
They are about 27%.
27%, okay. And I guess here's a couple of things that I wanted to... My concern is that, and I don't know how to change this concern, because I understand that we have, you know, part of the whole point of the of adopting a 10-year plan, of the process that went into creating it, and then the HSOC, which is responsible essentially for overseeing and implementing it, was to continue to be eligible for HUD funding and a variety of other forms of funding. But 6 years into the 10-year plan, I don't see that we've made a huge impact on homelessness in our community when it comes to even the things that we're now focusing on. We're not buying housing. You know, there's SRO housing that's needed in order to get people into that.
Mm-hmm.
We have serious gaps in our mental health and drug and alcohol treatment as far as getting to the people who are the worst off. The people who are service resistant very often and are most difficult to reach, we don't do a good job of that. I don't, you know, I think that we're not making it. Basically, I think we have a bureaucrat. I think, and it's not our fault in the sense that I think that HUD set it up so that our approach is very bureaucratic, and I think that our approach continues to have a bureaucratic distance that hasn't allowed us to make the kinds of improvements that we need in the community, not just for the homeless folks, but also for the folks that get impacted by homelessness, whether it be in the creeks or in neighborhoods, in certain streets, et cetera. This is a growing problem everywhere, and we understand certainly in California, there's more homeless people in California than all the other states combined. But I guess I would like to see us, if we're going to focus on this 100,000 homes campaign, an actual plan with our, I guess, with the housers that might be on HSOC of how we're going to be able to acquire, whether it be, old motels or apartment complexes or something where these where the units are going to be made available for chronically homeless people so that wraparound services can happen to them. Because
mm-hmm.
I still think that, you know, and I would also like, we have a lot of staff people from different departments. I don't think that you can really learn about homelessness in our community unless you spend some time serving lunch over at Prado and unless you spend some time volunteering at Maxine or Echo or one of the overflow shelters, spend a night doing that as a volunteer. That's when I learned about it before I joined this board. Volunteering at an overflow, being first, that's what HUD wants. And then we're going to need to acquire some units. I mean, that's just the truth. We don't have enough units to put chronically homeless. If we have 27% of the homeless population is chronically homeless, we don't have units for those people
mm-hmm.
right now, or even half of those people probably.
Can I make a response?
Please.
And I agree that the only way to address homelessness really is to continue to add to our housing stock. We can use housing choice vouchers to use some of our housing stock, but the HSOC is the housing committee's working on some recommendations that it's going to be bringing to the board in terms of prioritizing some of its recommendations on prioritizing CDBG and home funds for particular types of projects that HSOC feels would help provide additional housing and kind of advance this down the road.
Okay. I understand. I guess my main concern that I'm going to put out there is at the end of this 10-year plan, or at least it doesn't have an end per se, but at the 10-year point in this county,
mm-hmm.
if all we have is a data collection system, better processes and tools for compliance or even for some benefit eligibility, but we don't have more units and we don't have better drug and alcohol and mental health, then I don't think that we will have said that we have been successful.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Ms. Arnold?
Yeah. Thank you. And I appreciate Supervisor Hill's remarks, but I first want to say, before I get into that, so coming onto the board new this year, I became the chair of the HSOC board, and I have learned a lot, and I have so appreciated working with Emily and Laurel. I see Mr. Collins in the audience. It's been a wonderful experience, and I am excited. I think it's been our good fortune to have Laurel come on board almost at the same time as me. You were there a little bit before me, but she brings with her her experience from working in Washington, D.C. on a variety of homeless issues, and she has the experience of watching programs that have worked and have not worked throughout the nation in different different situations. So I was first very impressed by that and by Laurel's just methodical approach to really trying to provide results. So that goes to Supervisor Hill's concerns. What I've learned from working with these folks is that just like everything else, homelessness isn't a one-size-fits-all. There are a variety of circumstances and a variety of effective means of coping with it. I think that, number one, Laurel rolled up her sleeves and tried, through her experience of what's worked and what she's seen not work, she's trying to affect the methodology to provide more pertinent information to address the problem. So that's her first approach, was to just let's actually define what we want to do and what we want to do first. And then introducing us to the 100,000 Homes campaign, it was very well received by the entire HSOC board. But again, the goal to end homelessness, this 100,000 Home campaign falls right into that. It's a campaign that's based on the fact that services will be more effective. In other words, it's about a more effective use of our programs. Our chronic homeless population is aging and having a more difficult time, and Laura can correct me if I'm wrong, but stats show that somewhere around 10% of this chronic homeless population ends up receiving 90% of the services, maybe not all what we consider homeless services, but medical services in our emergency rooms and services involving law enforcement. So the fact that you can take those folks and make the services, I guess the way to say this is the services that we have to provide will be more effective when we've actually given those folks a permanent home and stabilized them in that way. And so it is all about permanent housing. Laurel's a hard worker and very ingenious and, again, comes to us with a lot of experience in dealing with all this. But one example, and you could actually thing that Laurel has that is, I think, very beneficial to us is she understands the bureaucracy in Washington, D.C., and very effectively and very calmly deals with it, actually. As programs change and we're asked to comply in different ways, she understands how to make those shifts, and I really appreciate that of her as well. But an example of being able to identify homes, we were talking not very long ago with VA and...
Liz, and even when this whole thing started, I talked to a lot of folks that this is not going to make it. We don't have the money to be able to accomplish all the things we want to be able to do. So I guess what I'm asking is, would it be more appropriate to change that, to try to find some other, I guess, I hate to put a target number on something because it's going to be, I think we're setting ourselves up for failure to say we're going to end homelessness in 10 years. It isn't going to happen. So I don't know where we're going to go with this, and I know you've just come on board. You've come up with a lot of ideas, good innovation in terms of trying to address this, but now we're into the sixth year of this that I think you're kind of charged with 4 years to try to make it work, and I don't know how that's going to happen. So I guess I don't want to set us up for failure by putting that target number there. So just a thought.
If I could jump in at this point, and we'll get back then to Ms. Arnold and Mr. Hill. You know, when we did approve the 10-year plan to end homelessness, we knew, I think, in our heart of hearts on the board at that time that was not likely a goal. You know, we were not going to see zero homelessness at the end of 10 years. It was a target. It was a very worthy goal. And how we motivate ourselves to aspire to do what we know we need to do. I think we can talk about that. But I too wanted to follow up on Mr. Hill's observation. And the way I read is, I read the staff report in looking at the responses to various expectations or targets that were laid out. We were coming up short in a number of places. We weren't getting services on the ground that we wanted to get on the ground. And it seemed to me very clear that we were spending a lot of our time and effort and money dealing with the bureaucracy of this. Now, it would be helpful, I think, to this board to have some measure of, you know, time or money or effort. You know, how much is going to service the bureaucracy and how much is actually getting out into the community to address the human need that we have here? And it wasn't completely clear to me. I mean, I saw a number of things that we had adapted to, a number of things that we didn't accomplish, a number of things that changed on us. But I think it would be helpful, as we set policy here, to have that, what's our overhead, essentially? And then the second question or observation is, within the bureaucratic structure that drains some of our resources, how much of that is our bureaucracy and how much of that is imposed upon us by other agencies? And again, the staff report talks a little bit about that, but we got two things we can do. Is one of them, if it's our bureaucracy, we can deal with that, and we should deal with that. If it's imposed upon us, that's a little tougher problem, but I think we need to maximize our innovation, and we need to maximize our advocacy, and we have advocacy at state and federal levels that we can apply. And we make this a priority. I think we need to start banding together with those who are involved in this elsewhere in the state, elsewhere in the nation, to do the advocacy that reduces that overhead. So, again, trying to get a little clearer picture of what the balance of that is, and can we tell the story that we would be providing more of these services except that these resources are being drained. And with that, I'd go to Ms. Arnold and then Mr. Hill.
Well, again, I just want to stress one thing that I've learned that I think is really important here is the being able to target certain populations. So the chronic homeless and the aging chronic homeless population is one population to deal with, and they're very different than the folks that our emergency shelters. Those are very important as well for a different population. So I think what Laurel's trying to do is customize to again, just more effectively use the programs that we've always had in place, but maybe target the services to the populations and more comprehensively identify the needs so that those programs will be able to work.
All right. Mr. Hill?
Well, I would say the thing that we're struggling with is how to make both the bureaucratic compliance and actually have a practical approach that's going to better address the problem. If we're 6 years into it, then how about a four-year plan to acquire 10 SROs, you know, three in North County, three in South County, four in SLO, and then you have a practical thing to measure, and you can say, okay, we've done this. This has allowed for 10 chronically homeless people and future for us to do that. If we have a 10-year plan to get a detox, if we have a way to find how we can better work with all of our agencies to deal, you know, because a lot of the chronic homeless, as we know, because I've spent time with Mr. Hamm, I've spent time with Mr. Collins, even in recent instances about this, we have service resistance. I think a fair question that the public has to ask is, what are we getting for that specifically? Because they're not going to be impressed by data collection systems when they see people living in the creek.
Well said, Mr. Hill. And with that, let me open it to the public. We have received four requests to speak. Dr. C. Height, followed by Eric Greening.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos Rural Community Workshop. Those HUD vouchers could be home ownership for the county, for the people of Los Osos who face displacement. What has been done to provide housing security? Homelessness creates mental suffering, and you call it mental illness. March 4th, 2003, Board Minutes show I spoke about housing discrimination and a cause of homelessness. What has been done in 10 years? 25% of the population is disabled, including a demographic in Los Osos Baywood Park. In Slo County, disabled is synonymous with houseless, like veteran became synonymous with houseless. The press continues to spotlight the homeless as profitable beggars. Why do we stereotype homeless people as if they are all the same people, the same person, like blacks all have the same known characteristic? And those homeless characteristics were identified in this chamber by well-intentioned people as mentally ill, drug, alcohol addicted, choose to be homeless, and other. Other includes the underserved senior disabled of Los Osos who can't maintain their home due to the lack of in-home support services through social services. And yes, that is recorded. Can't maintain their independent living and get their own groceries and prescriptions without dial-a-ride in District 2, Los Osos Baywood Park. May 13th, 2003, I advocated the board against warehousing the poor at the airport, away from community, public transportation, grocery stores, schools. And 2002, I ask you to not give the money to the same people who did nothing all these years, because you almost lost your HUD grant choosing crisis to throw money at. I invited the public to attend a meeting at my Los Osos home, and Gwen Taylor came to witness just how home ownership in Los Osos would be handled. And yes, that was recorded. And I lost the opportunity to own and manage my triplex through HUD programs by being wrongfully accused of being a bad tenant suddenly. What has been done to provide restaurant meal allowance to Los Osos? It has taken 10 years of advocation for this hidden service to be recognized by the powers that be. What has our District 2 supervisor done to support the senior disabled demographic of Los Osos Baywood Park now that we are taxed and outpriced by the Los Osos Sewer Project? And it's called Services for Family Success, and this county has had a long-standing reputation for not providing it, and that goes back to 1997. I again want to thank Paso Robles for being responsible on issues of housing and disability, but seniors need to remain integrated and be allowed to live on the coast for health and climate reasons.
Thank you, Dr. Height. Mr. Greening, followed by Lindy Owen.
Thank you. Eric Greening, I'll start with the positive. I'm very glad to see work now toward a warming center in North Interior. It has a different climate. It's hotter there now, but it's quite a bit colder in the winter. We have seasons, and this is a lifesaver. I think some of this discussion has ferreted out. If I were to ask the question, halfway through our 10-year plan to end homelessness, have we managed to help half of the homeless that were there 5 years ago be housed? And the answer is no. We are not in a credible 10-year path to end homelessness, if that is the measurement. And I'm glad to hear some forthright, honest eliciting of that. I think to kind of turn Dr. Heitz, one of her points, into a question, where nearly half reported mental health issues, how many of those had pre-existing mental health issues and how many developed mental health issues as a result of the stress of homelessness, sleep deprivation, having to hide from the law for your very existence to be allowed, since you would probably be part of the 89% that didn't have shelter. There are not many legal places to actually spread your body out. Anyway, those can create mental health crises, whether there was a pre-existing now. Of course, then we'd have the FEMA bureaucracy instead of the HUD bureaucracy, but that's another story. But we need to recognize there is a considerable population that has been affected by an economic tornado. people who are fully capable of making autonomous decisions and who are not going to go for help that compromises assumptions about that ability to make autonomous decisions. That's a considerable part of this population, and it's not being addressed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Ms. Owen, followed by Richard Margetson.
Lindy Owen from Los Osos. I really appreciate the report and the update, and I definitely recognize the challenges to finding housing for all levels of homelessness. What I really see lacking here is, as Eric Greening said, it is an economic tsunami that has hit this country, and this county is no different. I do not see this county purchasing rundown units in order to get in at a reasonable price and upgrading them. I do not see that happening. When I've asked why we couldn't do it, it was there wasn't enough money. I do not see the safe parking program established. Those that do have vehicles have no safety wherever. I mean, they are constantly either upsetting neighborhoods or living in fear that they could be damaged while they sleep in their vehicles. I do not see this county taking one step forward to produce a safe parking program. And really what this county needs is a tent city. This is a disaster, and it's not going away. A tent city could allow people to have a safe place to at least have shelter and have some self-respect. You could have bathing facilities. You could have dining facilities, a soup kitchen. The Dan Duval Ranch is the ideal design to develop some housing in this county to just address that we don't have places. We're never going to have houses for all the people that need them. And you can begin addressing social issues when you begin setting up structure that gives people some pride and some self-reliance and someplace to build a new life. So I would beg that you look at the Dan Duval Ranch plan and go with as many of those that could be set up, I think would be fabulous. And then I really want to ask, how can the county simultaneously fight homelessness while creating it? And this has been brought up many times in Los Osos. There was never an accurate affordability study done in Los Osos. And there were choices on what kind of sewer was put in. And the sewer that was put in is over $100 million beyond what the less expensive one was. And so, therefore, what we see now is we see people losing their homes. We see rentals jacked up, because now there is, you know, they're paying the extra $800 in taxes on some cases. This sewer is definitely impacted the housing, affordable housing in Los Osos. We used to be a bedroom community. No, we're on the way to a much higher end community, because only the wealthy will live in Los Osos as this sewer project continues. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Mr. Margetson.
Richard Margetson. First of all, I think one of the accomplishments this year was actually the hiring of Laurel. Long overdue, was advocated for before some of you were even on the board. Just a little background history. I was part of the steering committee with Dana and four other members of the community that actually helped establish the bylaws and the structure for HSOC. We had many heated debates and discussions on how we wanted it set up. Some of us wanted more community members, more service-based organization representation, but it shook out the way it did. I still have an issue with the number of elected officials on HSOC, because I believe that, you know, especially at the beginning, the meetings were basically a tutorial to bring everybody up to speed. And those meetings were being held every month. You're now down to meeting six times a year. This agenda item is about the Homeless Oversight Council update, or annual update. We're talking about bureaucracy. We're talking about a lack of accomplishment of dealing with the homeless issue. You brought Laurel on. Is there truly a need for HSOC anymore? Originally, HSOC was funded at $150,000 from contributions from all of the cities, Capslo. They all participated. They had a halftime of the audience sat next to me and said, Richard, if I resign right now, will you take my position? And I said no. And he stayed on, and eventually he left the council because he felt it was ineffective.
Thank you, Mr. Margetson. We'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board. This is a receive and file item. Are there any further comments or questions from my colleagues? Not Mr. Buckshine?
Let me add a couple comments, if I may, to kind of summarize what I heard a bit. You know, very directly I heard, obviously, the focus to focus more on direct programs where we can and less on the bureaucracy. That's obviously a message that was well sent. And I think something that we can do at the staff level rather easily is identify the allocation of money for what's being spent on what could be categorized as bureaucracy versus direct programs and how much of that is a local versus federally mandated bureaucracy. And I can't say anecdotally, in fairness to staff, the vast majority of it is federally mandated bureaucracy, but we'll do the data mining to support that anecdotal comment. You know, with respect to the 100,000 Homes campaign, I do just want to emphasize that this will be a big shift for this community in terms of housing first and moving folks into housing. And you hit the nail on the head. We haven't had the housing available, and finding it will be a challenge, as we've seen with trying to site some homeless centers. There's a big reluctance in many parts of the community to have homeless located near certain individuals or certain areas of the city. But I think additionally a point that's going to make this challenging, and it can certainly be overcome, but I think it will probably create some squawking amongst some of our partners, is that the federal funding is the lion's share of our homeless programs, and that funding is not going to increase anytime soon. In fact, it's likely to decrease given the current federal budget situation. So if we shift to a housing first 100,000 homes campaign, that means a redirection of existing allocations to some of our not-for-profits and other partners, which some will join on and others will likely resist that. And so I just want to make it clear that moving in this direction will not be easy. We'll be changing some forces that have been at play for quite some time. But all that being said, you know, I think we all want the same thing. We recognize homelessness isn't getting better at the rate that everybody would like it to. So we'll continue on this path. We do have regular meetings with our cross-functional county team and with other community partners. We'll continue to do that and build upon this direction that your board gave us today.
Thank you, Mr. Buckshine. Mr. Hill?
Yeah, just one final thought in returning to something that I had suggested before. I really think it would behoove all of the members of HSOC and our staff members who work on issues related to homelessness on any level spend time, serious time. I mean, spending a night volunteering at one of the shelters or one of the overflow shelters is a very difficult experience. Even serving lunch at Prado can be difficult if there's 150 people there and many who are in great need of mental health. Spend time in cities that have rangers and police that are continually having to, like this city and others in our community, that are having to deal with some of the impacts of folks who are really resistant to services, and therefore they're living in creeks or they're living in encampments that get improvised in various areas. That will help, I think, close some of the distance that comes from the, you know, and I do understand that it's necessary, but close some of that bureaucratic distance by spending time with that. I think that I've tried to do that, and it has been, you know, it has certainly made me realize that some of the ways that I thought we could be most successful are a lot more difficult to achieve. So I hope that we see people doing that. I think that would help the HSOC certainly be more effective.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. I'd like to thank staff and all the community members who work on this very, very tough problem. In light of Mr. Buckshine's comments and the board's direction, trying to plan out next steps. It sounds to me like the shift in strategy to the 100,000 Homes campaign is really going to cause a lot of ripples if we embrace this fully in an effort to really go down that path. And in coupled with Mr. Buckshy's desire, which I appreciate, to sort of sort out the overhead versus the direct problems, when do you think we could be back before this board with a clear sense of what we do so that the time after that we're going to have some results that we can be proud of? What kind of time frame does staff think they need?
I can. Let's regroup on that, and I'll get back to you with the time. I'd like to do a little data mining and discussion with staff. We can come back.
We do have strategic planning coming up this
to focusing after that on the rest of our variety of homeless solutions for the rest of the population. So, Laurel, is that, and again, maybe just a quick second to say, this isn't something that we're just thinking, wow, this sounds good, let's try it. But this has been tried, in fact, in many places across the country with good results. And so we're just trying to take the benefit of some tried and true practices and bring them here to our communities.
Yeah. And we will be moving forward with that. And one of the kind of hallmarks of the campaign is actually to try to set some numeric goals for number of people that you're going to house per year, so that we're going to be convening a leadership team of key agencies, our key nonprofit partners, as well as other critical agencies in the community, and they will be coming up with setting a goal for that. And I do want to say also that, you know, there are other efforts going on that it won't lead to the abandoning of servicing, for example, homeless families. Those efforts will continue, but there will be a focus in particular on this population and really coordinating our efforts in a way and doing things differently.
All right. With that, this is receive and file. Again, thank you for that. I've had at least one request from a colleague for a break, so we will take one. And let us reconvene at 11:25.
Microphones are live.
All right. Thank you very much, Madam Clerk. We will reconvene the morning session. And if you would please introduce our next item.
Your next item would be item 17, submittal of a resolution to amend the position allocation list for Fund Center 180, Social Services Administration, to add 24 full-time employees in various classifications to support implementation of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act and request to authorize a corresponding budget adjustment in the amount of $2,205,774.
Mr. Collins.
Good morning, Chairman and members. Unlike the last item, there's no bureaucracy to be discussed here. As we know, the Affordable Care Act has been the subject of a great deal of political discussion in Washington and elsewhere. At the Department of Social Services, we don't really have the luxury of having an opinion on it. We're only charged with implementing it. And so what we have is federal law that passed in 2010, state law that passed this year that mandates the implementation of the act and sets out the requirements to do so. And so I am before you today with $2.2 million in allocation from the State Department of Health Care Services to implement the act, and with the position request that you have before you. Now, I do have a PowerPoint that I've prepared that I will try to go through quickly or tortuously if you ask me to slow it down. But
do I have a motion on that from the board? I think quickly is the...
So these are the issues that we're facing, and
that's very quick. That's
we will discuss the basics, governance, the issues that you see in front of you, the implementation activities, primarily what we'll be focusing on, and the outstanding needs. Just a little reminder in terms of the urgency, the open enrollment for the act begins in just under 50 days. And the coverage begins in 140 days. So we have to be prepared to begin taking applications on October 1st and to make people eligible on January 1st. Little basics, as you noted, passed in 2010. Some of the factors of the act are already in place. Persons with pre-existing conditions must be covered. Youth up to age 26 covered on a parent's plan. Recent changes have extended that to foster parents, which is of great interest to those of us in the Department of Social Services. Other preventive services are covered. But the key issues for us now include the Medicaid expansion and the tax-based subsidies through state-based exchanges, both of which the Department of Social Services has a great deal of responsibility for implementation. These are presented side by side. On the left, the Medicaid, or in California, Medi-Cal expansion, brings eligibility up to 138% of the federal poverty limit. And primarily who we're talking about are persons who single adults or couples who have no children, who are not disabled, and who are not elderly. And those are specified because those persons who meet the income requirements already are covered under Medi-Cal. The tax subsidy or the exchange-based coverage, that brings it all the way up to 400% of the federal poverty limit for folks who are not otherwise eligible for a Medicaid or Medi-Cal. And that approximately 73% of those will be found eligible. And you'll see statewide numbers. Additionally, they project that 999 county residents will apply for coverage under the tax credit or the subsidized plan. 2.6 million statewide. This is the governance. As you can see, everything flows downhill. In terms of our current county operations, we have, you see the box over on the right of the slide there. This is the entire department. We have 25,530 cases of all kinds. This is a 45% increase in caseload since 2007-2008 and reflects the results of the recession. Now, that has begun to moderate slightly in some areas, particularly in CalWORKs. It is not moderating in the CalFresh program nor in the Medi-Cal program, even without expansion. We currently have 427 staff residing in five regional offices throughout the county. We currently take applications in person, online, over the phone, by mail. We expect much more activity online and over the phone related to the call centers, which we'll talk about in a moment. And we also have the County Medical Services Program. This is an indigent health program with which you're familiar. The bulk of those individuals now will be eligible for Medi-Cal. And so what we propose and the FTEs that we're requesting is inclusive of those individuals, three, I believe, coming over from the health agency to the Department of Social Services, where we will be managing eligibility for the CMSP. So we have experience with change. Change is a constant in our business. We haven't seen anything quite like this in several years. We have an automation system that already is in use by 18 counties as part of a consortium. There is a new system that's being built for the exchange with new programs. The programs must be interfaced to work together, and at this point, the vendor chosen by the state has been unable to do that. They will not be able to do it by October 1st, which means my staff will be running two systems as opposed to an integrated one. We sincerely doubt whether they will be able to have it prepared by January 1st. This does have implications for customer service, obvious implications for workload, where we will have individuals toggling between screens, inputting information twice because of the failure of the state and its contractor to operate efficiently, a luxury we don't have. You see the phone network and the arrow that describes a warm handoff. There will be an 800 number that will be published extensively in PSAs and elsewhere where individuals can call this number to determine whether or not they are eligible. Of course, folks can still come into our department and apply as they always have or by phone, but the expectation is that a lot of people who are potentially eligible will call this 800 number. To the extent, based on their screening, that they are eligible for a purchase of private insurance under the exchange, they will be handled by those who answer the phone in these call centers. To the extent that it is believed that they are more likely eligible for Medi-Cal, that call, the person will essentially be placed on hold while we are called, and then there will be this introduction to our staff by the person whom they had called at one of the 800 number call centers. And we will proceed to determine their eligibility and take the case from there. Under the state requirement, 80% of the calls to the counties must be answered by a live person within 30 seconds, and furthermore, we must have extended hours. This is something new for our department, where we've been basically an 8-to-5 operation Monday through Friday, except for emergency cases involving child welfare. We now will be open until 8 o'clock in the evening, and we will be open on Saturdays from 8 to 8 initially, going down a little bit to about 5 p.m., I believe, on Saturdays after 6 months. So significant new staffing needs and hours in terms of our availability to the public. So the question isn't really whether a client is eligible for a program, because virtually everyone is eligible, and the question is, to what are they eligible? All doors should lead to coverage, whether it's through CMSP, through the Medi-Cal programs, through Covered California. Anyone who walks in our door, we will determine if they are eligible not merely for Medi-Cal, but also if they are eligible for coverage under the exchange, the private insurance. We will handle their case, determine eligibility, sign them up, and at that case, instance, the ongoing case responsibility is transferred to the exchange, but we're still responsible for doing all the case processing. And that's that 999 applications that was predicted. So the expectations of us is to understand all these new rules, because even within the expansion of the Medi-Cal program, as mentioned on an earlier slide, there are differences from the way that the balance of the Medi-Cal case classifications. We have significant turnover over the course of a year. Every year right now, we start a new class of eligibility staff, or employment resource specialists, as we call them, anywhere from 18 to 24 new individuals every year, just through natural turnover. If, in fact, the impact of the Affordable Care Act is less than has been predicted, through normal attrition, we will release those positions. If it's greater than what has been predicted, then the state will allocate additional funds to us, and we will be back before you with requesting authority to add those funds to our budget and to expand staff as necessary. In my 30 years as a director and a CAO, I've never had to lay off a staff person, and it's not my desire to start now. So we do fund conservatively. We've requested authority today to expend about 79% of this funding on staffing. We could have requested more, but I think that we're playing it very safe with what we have before you. And the state will be working on a permanent methodology for third year and beyond. So the timeline, we are already down to summer of 2013, where we are in the process of developing our call center. We are having training for all staff in these various programs. On October 1st, we have to throw open the doors and the call center to anyone interested in applying. On January 1st, their coverage begins. The key challenges for us has primarily been the absolute galloping incompetence of the Department of Health Care Services. And I hate to say that, because we've had a good relationship with our state departments over my many years in this business, but I've never seen anything like what they're showing us now in terms of just inattention to duty. That doesn't give us a pass. We still have to be ready, and we will be ready for anything that they throw at us. But, you know, the expectation of our community is that we begin taking applications on October 1st and providing coverage on January 1st. So the fact that they have been unable to get two systems to talk to one another, the extent to which that they have dragged their feet in issuing key guidelines and answering questions that have been frequently asked, again, that's a challenge for us. And it's one that ultimately will require a political solution, and the legislature is well aware of their shortfalls in this area. But we do have the funding. We do have the basic expectation that we be ready, and we will have our automated systems ready to go. This I've touched on. This is the kinds of training and webinars and regional seminars. It's a massive undertaking that we're preparing. So for us, we have the 24 staff positions, and I'm prepared to answer questions about what any of them would be doing. We will have the transfer of staff and responsibility from the County Medical Services Program for eligibility purposes, training all the staff, purchasing and implementing the technology primarily related to the call center, just prepping facilities to accommodate the additional staff. Implementing the policies and then the ever-changing environment of the Affordable Care Act, and waiting instructions from the state and federal governments. So the vision is clear. You know, we will provide first-class customer service to individuals seeking help under the Affordable Care Act, and we will enhance our local agency culture to effectively promote health care coverage and access to these vital human services for all who are eligible. Some counties are facing challenges that we are not. Our staff already have responsibility for handling all kinds of cases. One staff person in my department, all of them, not only process applications for Medi-Cal, but also for CalFresh, for CalWORKs, and other programs. The expectation for those counties who have had it specialized and separated is that they become more like us. So that's a hurdle we've passed years and years ago. We're already doing that. So we're ahead of the game compared to many of our colleagues. So we will be able to determine eligibility for all programs for anyone who applies. But it's going to be a challenge, again, just to have the clarity and the resources that we need from the state. What I'm asking from your board today is for the resources that have been paid for by the State Department of Health Care Services to ensure that we're ready and that we can handle the expected flood of applications that will come in starting on October 1st. And we will keep you informed as to what that flood looks like. I'm anticipating a bit of a bell curve with a relatively slow start, rapid acceleration of folks applying as word of mouth and the PSAs and the other kinds of outreach occur, and then probably some tapering at some point in terms of application activity and more responsible for ongoing caseload. If I could briefly tie in to the previous presentation around homeless services. You'll recall that the Benefits Arch program had two goals in mind. One was to assist folks in becoming eligible for SSI.
In reading the staff report, not all the positions that you're asking for here are going to be simply answering phones. There's more to it in getting folks eligible, and there's no doubt, because we are the government, a certain amount of paperwork. I wanted to confirm whether your understanding was the same as mine at the CSAC Executive Committee last week. It was suggested that the actual Medi-Cal eligibility form is going to be quite streamlined, that there was statute in place that suggested that it need not be or will not be greater than two pages as opposed to a great many more than that right now. Is that your understanding as well?
That's certainly our hope. But again, the Medi-Cal regulations for the new population are much streamlined. There's no asset test, for example, where we have to, with existing Medi-Cal applicants, determine the cash surrender value of a life insurance policy, certain kinds of heirloom jewelry a family might possess. We don't have to determine those kinds of things for this population. We do continue to have to make those determinations for the folks who have been eligible for Medi-Cal under the old rules. So it's a new program that's added to approximately 140 other Medi-Cal programs. There's not a single program. There are multiple iterations. This is one more.
So the added workload is not as bad as it could have been, but it's not necessarily a reduction of your workload by any measure as we see here with the...
It is the addition of tens of thousands of individuals whose eligibility will be simpler than those right. tens of thousands already receiving
on board.
Assistance.
Very good. Mr. Meacham?
Lee, I'll go back to the point you made earlier about we would probably want to ask what happens after the 2 years if we don't have the funding in that regard. This kind of reminds me of the AB 109 until, you know, we got so much funding and then we were kind of nervous that they wouldn't get some kind of constitutional guarantee to provide that. Do you anticipate something like that coming down the line in terms of what the state wants to be able to guarantee to provide us with that funding? And if not, I'm really going to be interested to see how we make the adjustment for that amount of money.
Well, we had to make it's a question, obviously, that we've concerned ourselves with, Supervisor Meacham. And you know, during the recession, when the demand for our services increase, it's when funding that comes through the realignment program that supports our department decreases. It's the unfortunate paradox of how realignment funding works. This is not realignment funding. It's direct funding from the State Department. And it's certainly not beyond the realm of possibilities that the state would propose a decrease in funding. But they would only do so, really, based on numbers not rising to the levels that had been predicted. In other words, if we're not getting, the 10,000 or, 9,179 new applications, the 6,700 new cases, the 999 applications under the exchange, if the numbers don't reach that level, then in the third year, it would be perfectly reasonable for the state to say, you don't need all the money that we've been providing you, and we're going to ratchet it back. We'll be prepared for that.
And I understand, too, that there's about $500,000 that's going to be in a reserve to where we're not going to spend this entire amount unless we need it.
We would not be able, the fiscal year is already, nearly 2 months, or we're a month and a half into the fiscal year. With your action today, would trigger the recruitment, which would trigger the hiring process. We won't have these folks on.
No, I understand that.
Time.
The amount of money that's been suggested here, if I read the staff report correctly, about $500,000 of that would not be spent currently.
There's funding that's been set aside for unforeseen areas in overhead. There's additional fixed assets, although we haven't put the funding in fixed assets, line account, but if there's additional expectations for computer equipment or software or anything else, we've set that funding in reserve. If we don't spend it, we don't spend it. Okay. But we did not want to put all of our eggs in the staff basket, if you will, just because we don't know what all will be required once we get going.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Indeed, this is almost as big a deal as AB 109 realignment. It's certainly been a considerable discussion at the state level between counties and the state agencies that are going to participate in this. And I had another extensive conversation with Mr. Hamm about what the Affordable Care Act is going to mean to health care in this county. And he indicates that sometime in this fall he's going to be bringing some rather substantive policy issues that we've got to figure out that will speak directly to this long-term stream. I think one thing that's worth noting is that the state, while they're looking to take back money and in theory will be able to carry on and do our business, the state doesn't incur any cost in the first 3 years of this program. The federal government is funding the entirety of this. Great deal of trepidation both within the first 3 years.
And you had two clinics, CHC and Family Care, CHC being a federal clinic. Okay, this was followed with voting to deny Medi-Cal to the homeless. This was a county choice. The county then cut out dental, eyeglasses, and chiropractic at CHC after partnering with this company. And then they tried to end indigent health care, and I have a copy of that letter. Then you blamed CHC for overpaying its staff. You have a crisis, so by all means, throw money at it. There is a health care crisis, and now you don't have the choice of cutting out health care randomly. Arbitrarily, now you have a mandate, and you are going to need to pay the staff. You have a crisis, and you're going to throw money at it, but you have to be sincere. April 6, 2004, I spoke about the hidden benefit of medical deductions. I spoke about malpractice and the county being sued by Dr. Niemark when the county chose to cut out all the pediatricians. So you have a history, and I'm researching the board minutes. And I also remember the day that people came forward and talked about how over 70% of the people eligible for food stamps weren't getting them, and DSS almost lost its food stamp grant. So you have to be sincere, because you are putting the responsibility of people coming to social services to get health care to not be arbitrarily turned away and to get the health care that will benefit them. I also was in the room when Lee Collins came forward and told you that social services was in crisis because of theft by employees. So you must be sincere, because not providing the services that could make a healthy community, in San Luis Obispo County was so common not getting the services that DSS didn't even notice that their workers were stealing from women who were trying to escape a predatory environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height. We'll close public comment, bring it back to the board. If there are no further questions or comments, I'll entertain a motion on staff's recommendation.
Move approval.
Second. Thank you, Mr. Hill. Ms. Arnold, with no further discussion, Madam Clerk, a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Mr. Collins, and good luck. With that, I will reopen public comment for items not on the agenda. Mr. Margetson?
Richard Margetson, last week at the end of your agenda item on the groundwater basin in North County, after the supervisors from those two districts spoke, it came back to Mr. Gibson, and the quote on the overhead is how he started out his, how some people took it, scolding of the two of you. There is reality. And then there is the acceptance of reality. For years, Mr. Meacham will attest to this, after the rates and charges ordinance for the Los Osos wastewater project was approved by this board at that hearing, and at least a dozen times since then, I've stated that the commercial district was underrepresented in the rates and charges ordinance. 4% of consumption was staff's belief, which no, with no basic up-to-date documentation. The documentation I presented was more current than what was in the staff report. Numerous documents have come out from the purveyors individually in the last 2 years. I've brought them forward. I put them on the overhead. Well, recently, the basin management plan for Los Osos was released, the draft plan. The three purveyors control the water supply in the urban area of Los Osos, put out their document as a requirement of the ISJ process per year. The base charge. On top of that, they're going to be charged $7.54 per unit on their December, January, or January, February billing cycle. 15%, even if you go on the 80-20 breakdown of indoor-outdoor consumption, if 80% of it's indoor, and that's 12%. That rate is three times more. These numbers go up three times, and I'm wondering when Mr. Gibson's going to inform the commercial district
that
information.
Thank you, Mr. Margetson. Your time is up. Thank you. With that, we'll close general public comment, and our next item on the agenda is closed session. Council, are we going to have closed session today?
Reed and Neal County Council, there are no items to discuss in closed session today.
All right. That said, Mr. Margetson, you did file a request speak on closed session. Can you hold those comments until we do have closed session?
Absolutely, no.
All right. Then I will recognize you to speak on the closed session items, because they are on the agenda. I would ask that you keep your comments to those items.
I will be talking about future litigation. Two issues. What happened this morning is something for you to seriously address in closed session, because if this continues, this process of how you handle public comment, I'm going to contact California Aware. This, your speaker slip alone is illegal. The reference to no slanderous comments, no profane, it's not for the chair to determine that. It's also not for the chair to determine new rules. Even if you have a policy that says that. Just because you have a policy doesn't mean the policy is right. It doesn't comply with the spirit of the Brown Act. Tom Dawson was standing, filling out his speaker slip on consent calendar when Mr. Greening was speaking. Turned his slip in. When Mr. Gibson announced public comment, I walked. And I was testing him. I was testing you, Mr. Gibson. Because I'm absolutely ashamed that you would take this stance on public comment. I hear you saying, oh, we welcome public comment. You do not. I know you despise me. I know you despise the people of Los Osos coming week after week. I know it's bothering you that these things we talk about are starting to come to fruition. You know what also bothers me? Out of just pure respect for Mr. Teixeira, out of pure respect for Mr. Teixeira and his predecessor, Mr. Ashajian, who used to say repeatedly, I don't care if we're here till 10 o'clock at night. I want to hear all public comment. He repeatedly said that. And out of respect for Mr. Teixeira, who took all public comment, anytime somebody turned a speaker slip in at the beginning, middle, or end of an item, out of pure respect for Mr. Teixeira, until you get to take over, that's how you should be handling it. The other thing I want to talk to you about is you're going to have something come before you in the next month dealing with the Los Osos Wastewater Project. There's a fraud being perpetrated on the residents of Los Osos and the funding of the wastewater project with respect to one of the subcontractors that are working on the project. There's one more piece of evidence we're waiting for, hard copy piece of that evidence, and we'll be bringing it to you. It's going to be interesting to see how you handle that and what the process will be. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Margetson. We are adjourned then till 1:30.
Your microphones are live.
They are when I push the button. Thank you very much, Madam Clerk. We are reconvening the August 13th meeting of the Board of Supervisors. We did not hold closed session today, so there is real truth to the fact that there's no reportable action.
She wants to shrug.
That's right. She said nothing. With that, we have two items for the afternoon. Madam Clerk, would you introduce the first one, please?
Your item 19, a request to discuss and appoint one of three applicants to the Airport Land Use Commission, Larry Cooper, Adam Burden, or Tim Williams.
All right. Thank you, Madam Clerk. I don't know that there is staff prepared to open this up unless council would like to give us a little framework within which to consider
sure.
this decision.
Reading the Yolo County Council, per the statute and ordinance, this board appoints members to the Airport Land Use Commission. There is currently an opening on that commission. Oh, I'd say a couple months ago there was an application couple applications, and one was withdrawn due to a potential conflict. At that point in time, the board indicated that they'd like to look at a number of applicants. Each of the applicants were originally going to be prepared to give a brief statement to the board. If Mr. Cooper is prepared to do that, he can, and then this board can choose to appoint Mr. Cooper or take other action as you see necessary.
Thank you, Council. And I think it might be useful for the listening public and the record to indicate the Airport Land Use Commission is created under state statute to monitor and advise on land uses in the area surrounding the airport. It is not a governing board of the airport property itself. That solely rests with this board through the county operation of San Luis Obispo Regional Airport. So with that as a staff report, Mr. Cooper, if you'd like to take a few minutes and tell us about your interest in the Airport Land Use Commission, I'll then open it to the public, although at this point I have no request to speak.
So much for the public.
Yeah.
Thank you for the opportunity to serve on the commission. I've lived in the county all my life. I've been involved in the airport. My folks had an FBO out there since 64. We still have hangar rental facilities out there. And, you know, I guess my goal, Paul asked me to serve on the commission about 3 weeks before his passing, and we've been good friends for years, and I said, sure, if that helps him on out or helps the board and the county out. And, but my big thing out there is I don't want to see the county spending millions and millions and millions of dollars buying up neighborhoods because we weren't prudent early on in holding back some of the growth and that in the areas of the airport. LAX is going through that right now, and it's costing them a fortune. So with that, I'm open to questions.
Okay. We did get your letter of interest. Are there any questions from my colleagues and Mr. Cooper? Seeing none, I'll go through what I think is a formality of opening it to the public with no request to speak. I'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board for action.
I'd move approval of Mr. Cooper.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham and Mr. Hill. And this can be conducted on a voice vote, so without further discussion, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. And opposed, none. Thank
now's
you.
Now's time to say no.
And Kat, right. Yeah. Did you want rebuttal time? thank you for your willingness.
Good luck.
A lot of interesting issues. Good luck.
That's
a great send-off, Mr. Hill. Very good. All right. With that, Madam Clerk, if you would then introduce our other item.
That would be item 20, a request to receive and file the project update, adopt contract documents, approve the incorporation of specifications for materials, products, and control systems, and authorize processes for public bidding for construction services for the Women's Jail Expansion Project located at 1585 Kansas Avenue, San Luis Obispo, California. Set bid opening date for Thursday, September 26, 2013.
Thank you. And Chief Deputy, Ms. Pell, I'll turn it over to you both. Jointly and separately.
Good afternoon. Jeanette Pell and I are here to bring you an update on the Women's Jail Expansion Project and request approval to advertise for construction bids for this project. Additionally, representatives from Cannon Corporation, the Women's Jail Expansion Project Managers, and Arcadis Construction Manager are here to answer any questions. Okay, and I'm driving. There we go. A little bit of a refresher here for everyone. The project is located next to the current county jail at the County Operational Center and is shown in the highlighted areas above. First, the housing unit, the medical facility, the security electronics, and the optional IRC Sallyport components of the project. Attachment A in your board packet outlines the chronology of board actions regarding the women's jail expansion. The state has funding available to assist in the construction of this project, which is funded through lease revenue bonds. It will alleviate overcrowding in the women's jail and provide much-needed medical and programming space for all inmates. It will also provide a replacement security system for the entire jail.
So the project components are the new housing unit, the new medical facility, and the new security system, which will be part of the new housing unit and medical facility, as well as the existing jail. There is an optional bid item that is the remodel of the intake release center and the Sallyport. Decision to construct this optional bid will be based on how good the bids come in when we actually receive new support systems. They're going through each other. And in this particular case, they should be attached to one another so that they support and not, they need to be supporting one another. The second example are air handling ducts for the HVAC system, and they're going through support beams. So, again, that when we get into construction, that would be a problem. And then the last example is just another view of the HVAC system going through support beams. Identifying clashes during the final design phase will help keep costs down and reduce potential change orders in the project as we move forward. And this is all in part our effort to keep cost controlled during the project. So this is a 3D image of the housing unit. And this, again, this is 3D modeling, which is part of the BIM process. And it actually enables the sheriff's staff to envision the building early on and begin the process of developing operational and post-order documents. So it's something, again, new that we've been using in this particular project, and we believe that we've been able to identify some areas that would have caused issues during construction. So with that, I would like to turn the presentation over to John Evans from Cannon Corporation. He's going to talk about the project costs.
Mr. Evans.
Supervisors, it's good to see you today. A little update on what has happened as far as trying to pin down project costs since we came to last. The numbers that are up on the screen right now are reflective of the October 2012 construction cost estimate that was done by the project architect and their estimating consultant. And they were based on the 95% construction documents, which were the drawings available at the time. Since then, we've done two additional construction cost estimates. And both of them were based on what you could call the 99% construction documents. They weren't quite bid ready, but they were pretty close. They were the drawings that were available in April of this year. Arcadis, the construction management firm for the project, did a construction cost estimate, and as part of their efforts, they actually contacted some local suppliers and tried to make sure we weren't just using big city supply numbers, but actually local costs where possible. And then AECOM did another estimate based on their more updated drawings. And in summary, what we came up with were numbers very close to the ones that were done in October of 2012. So no significant deviation from that. Another thing, just as a byproduct of that effort, along with the clash detection that Ms. Pell was talking about, was also that the Arcadis, as the construction manager, did a constructability review of the drawings, identified areas where they felt like the drawings needed to be quote-unquote tightened up just to provide clearer information so that when the drawings actually do get submitted to the contractors, there's just less questions on the part of the contractors, resulting in just their better ability to give tighter bids on the project. So with that being said, the next step from a project cost estimate standpoint is really the real project cost that we're going to be presented with as soon as we get the construction bids back. If you have any questions, be glad to answer them. Otherwise, back to you, Jeanette.
Thank you.
I'll turn it back to staff here. Thank you, sir.
All right. So the numbers on this particular slide are exactly what you saw in March when we prepared the update. And we're not anticipating any changes, again, just as Mr. Evans said, until we actually receive the bids. We do realize that we still need some funding for this project, and we are working with the administrative office and the auditor's office to identify where the $5.3 million in other funding or reserves would come from. As mentioned last March when we presented to you, potential funding sources excluding the general fund include using facility planning reserves, public facility fees, building replacement revenues, or other reserves. So we will continue to work on this, and when we come back with the final bids, that will be when we will be able to discuss with you options for the additional funding. We are confident that we've done a thorough analysis and review of all the project details. We're going to put an entire package together, which will include who the lowest bidder was, and also there are some ancillary contracts that will need to be approved by the board. And for example, there'll be commissioning agent services, construction inspection and inspector of record services, construction testing and inspection services. Our architect, AECOM, we need to amend their contract to include construction administration. We will be asking your board to approve this project conditionally because the final step is for the Department of Finance to review the final bids and agree that we have actually selected the lowest bidder. So instead of coming back to the board on several occasions, we will ask that you approve it conditionally on approval of the Department of Finance. In November, about November 6th, we expect to get that approval. It's been a bit of a challenge, actually, having the state meet the deadlines that have been set. So we're optimistic that they'll be done within the two-week time frame that they say that they can turn those documents around. And then hopefully we'll be going out on December 4th with a notice to proceed. And this is really critical because once we issue that notice to proceed, the clock starts ticking on the project, and we only have 36 months to complete it, or we jeopardize losing our funding. So that'll be really a critical point in the project. And just to give you kind of a long-term view, substantial completion of the housing unit and security system is anticipated to be done in July 2015. April 2016, substantial completion of the medical facility. And then should we decide to do the optional components, those would be done in November 2016. And this is just kind of a picture view of the previous slides. Basically, the top schedule is the pre-construction schedule. And again, I want to note that the most important date on this particular timeline is that December 4th. I can get you there. Right there. That's really key. When we begin and give that notice, then the clock starts ticking. The lower bar identifies the base bid construction schedule, and so we just want to kind of give you a high-level view of what that would look like. So what we're recommending today is there are actually six recommendations, so bear with me. Receive and file the project update, adopt the contract documents, and authorize the county clerk to advertise to receive bids for construction services for the Women's Jail expansion, make the findings that particular materials, products, control systems that are components of the proposed construction of the Women's Jail expansion are to be designated by specific brand names or trade names to match other materials. And this is as authorized by Public Contract Code Section 3400C2. Direct staff to set forth brand name findings in the invitation to bidders and incorporate the requirements for the particular material, products, and control systems into the bid documents. Instruct the county clerk to give notice to bidders. Call for all sealed bids no later than 3 p.m. on September 26, 2013, and authorize the General Services Agency Director to adjust the bid date if necessary and consistent with the noticing requirements as set forth in Public Contract Code Section 22037. So in conclusion, the project remains on track, which is good news. And there are many agreements yet to be completed, and this is going to require constant management day to day. It's a very complex project, and but we've come a long way since we reported to you over the last several months. And that concludes our presentation, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Pell. Questions from my colleagues? Regarding this, I will note that we have had a good flow of information over the recent months as we got caught up, and I have received a couple of briefings. I assume my colleagues similarly. So it sounds like the questions have been handled by and large. I will open it to the public, although I have no request to speak. So I will close it to the public and bring it back to the board for action.
I need to make a correction.
Okay.
Sorry. On the recommendation number two, It needs to be adopt contract documents for the Women's Jail Expansion Project. And that was amended from, it eliminates the language instructing the clerk.